even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You are listening to Missed Apex Podcast. We live F1. Welcome to Missed Apex Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Spanners Ready, and I'm joined by Matt Trumpets. How's it going, Matt?
It is going great. We actually went and did a thing this morning in the city for the first time in ages.
I would love to ask you about that, but we've got an actual F1 team boss joining us. So instead, I'm going to rudely ignore you and remind everyone that we are an independent podcast produced in the podcasting shed with the kind permission of our better halves. We aim to bring you a race review before your Monday morning commute. We might be wrong, but we're first. Well, I tell you what, let's do a quick vote in the chat room. Do you want to hear Matt's New York Museum story, or do you want to hear from a former F1 team boss? They all voted that I should introduce Mr. Matthew Carter. Once again, Mr. Carter, thank you so much for your time.
No problem. No problem. Good to be here.
You were the ex-king of Lotus F1.
King?
Yeah, okay. That was the job title. Yep. Did you not strut around giving yourself...
Emperor. Hello, Emperor.
Okay, yeah, I'll go with that.
But that does give you a unique insight into the world of Formula One. It's been a while since we've spoken to you. Exciting things afoot in the world of Mr. Carter, but I don't think we're quite ready to talk about it. But you will come and talk to us when you've got your unique insight into life slightly back in the FIA bubble.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, in that case, why don't we, because I know Matt wants to talk about tyres, and I don't want to yet. I think the first
Matt always wants to talk about tyres.
No, he's obsessed. I think I'd like to start with, go on, Matt, go on, defend yourself.
Breaking news. We got Pirelli's official word about the cause of the failures at Azerbaijan. That's why I want to talk about the tyres.
Well, why don't you give us a summary of that, and we'll get Mr. Carter's impression also.
Well, as you know, there was lots of back and forthing, including a rumor that the teams might have been playing games. And the official cause is, here we go, circumferential break on the inner sidewall, which we don't care about, which can be related to the running conditions of the tire, which we kind of care about. And this is where I need your help. Pirelli goes on to say, in spite of the prescribed starting parameters, minimum pressure and maximum blanket temperature having been followed. Now, what does that really mean? You speak F1. What does that really mean? Because I know what that means to me, and it may not mean exactly what it sounds like it says.
I love coming on here and being thrown under the bus in the first instant. So tell me again. So it says that the pressures and temperatures weren't observed.
Oh, no. It says, in spite of the prescribed starting parameters having been followed.
I have to say, I have no idea.
Nice
so
one,
they're
Matt.
Saying that, so they're saying that the tire has failed as opposed to there being any debris. Is that the conclusion that they're drawing?
And it's due to the running conditions of the tire. But They're also saying that the starting parameters have been followed.
Did you ever fudge things then, Matthew, when it came to like tire pressures and stuff?
This is where we're going. You know it.
I remember having a conversation with the guys at Mercedes in my first year, and Mercedes used to take the allocation of tires from Pirelli and look at all of the tires and then decide which tires were the best for the race and which were going to be the best for, because there's slight differences in the tire construction, and they would have someone going, and we didn't have that at the time, and I was blown away. I just thought we had X number of rear rights and X number of front rights, and that we just used them. But they were specifically analyzing all of the tires and using different ones for race and practice. Aside from that, in my day, yes, you were allowed to play around with the pressures a little bit. There was even some teams that would swap left to right and right to left. But I think that all stopped after the Silverstone debacle of 2013. In terms of the statement from Pirelli, I don't know what they're saying. I mean, it appears to me that they're saying that the teams followed the procedures, but the tyres still failed. So I guess it sounds like Pirelli holding their hands up, which I wasn't expecting them to.
Okay, so there was a little bit of speculation that Red Bull and Aston Martin had been running a slightly lower temp pressure.
Pressure.
And does that make them more susceptible to failure if they had done it?
Yes. I mean, if you go outside of Pirelli's requirements, then I guess you're susceptible either way. Yeah. And lower pressure means that they move around a little bit more. You have to remember that they use, and Matt's going to love this, but they use the tires as part of the suspension. The suspension's really hard. So that tire wall is used to give them some sort of suspension. They'll play around with them and they'll push them to the limits. And obviously in Baku, they maybe push them past the limits.
Yeah. So I think a thing to remember, and I did have a conversation with Summers about this. So this is anything I'm about to say, if I get it wrong, that's on me, not on Summers. But it's important to remember that although they redesigned the front tires, they couldn't really redesign the rear tires because it would have cost too much money, because the whole back end of the car would have needed to have been redesigned with it. So they're still kind of running with last year's tires. Also important to remember, they raised the pressures 1 PSI on the rears overnight, which suggests that they were seeing more energy into the rear tire than they were happy with. And finally, just in talking about it, it's important to note that the race director's notes only specify the minimum starting pressure, and that not all the tires used in the race are necessarily at the start of the race.
So the question Matt is really getting to here is, how can we fudge things as a team when we get these parameters from Pirelli? Is there a way in race where we can go, okay, well, we've passed the test, but now we're able to run lower once we get going?
I don't think so. We certainly didn't do it, Lotus. I don't think so. I'm sure the very clever engineers in the F1 teams could think of something. But my opinion on it, or my view on it, is why would you do that if it's going to cause things like we saw in Baku? I mean, it seems to me that they're playing with fire a little bit. But F1 teams are always going to push the boundaries. I think I've said before, but I remember having dinner with Paul Hembree, who used to be the guy who was in charge of Pirelli. In Monza 14 or 15, and he was telling me then that Pirelli's job is a nightmare, because they're trying to sell tires at the end of the day. They want people to sell tires, and after Baku, are you really going to go in to buy new tires and say, yeah, I want the Pirelli ones like in F1? Oh, hang on a minute, maybe not. And yet they're being pushed by Formula One to make tires that fall off the cliff, to make tires that do degrade. So it's a difficult job for them, and they're still trying to market their tires. So I don't think you can put all the blame on them. There's also a huge lack of testing these days.
Yeah.
And also the cars, every year on year, the downforce is getting better and better and better, and that just puts more and more pressure on them as tire manufacturers. So it's a difficult job for them, and I do feel for them a little bit.
I had visions of you talking about your wing that was designed to lose one of its support struts so you could run lower. And if there was some magic trick where, I don't know, you just managed to like let a bit of air out. Oh no, we accidentally
hit a slow puncher in the tire.
Yeah, like a really slow. So it's time to just have better grip at the end.
I regret to tell you that no, we didn't have any of those tricks up our sleeve.
That's a shame. Although it is worth noting before we leave the topic that the teams actually control the pressure data that Pirelli and the FIA get during the race, because the valve stems that are used in the tires are custom designed by the teams to fit into the rims, which is something I found kind of interesting. So
kind of interesting.
Very well, you know, I'm just trying to think of the common Formula One fan here and not my own peculiar interest. But they are going to have an updated set of protocols and a new technical directive, you'll be happy to know, in order to keep this from happening again, whatever it was.
Yeah, listen, I mean, on a serious note, it makes sense, because you can't really have things like that happening without doing something about it. You know, the speed they're going, and, you know, I'm sure it's been talked to death on here and on many other platforms as well. But, you know, if Max had gone to the left instead of to the right, we could have been having a whole different conversation right now.
Shall I fire a listener question at you, Mr. Carter? Because I want to
go for it.
Look, there was, straight after that event you were just talking about, a lot of team radio that we could hear with Massey. Jason Miller asks, were the team's mid-race radio interactions with Charlie Whiting similar to the interactions we've heard with Michael Massey? Or does Massey have a different approach? Could you get on the blower and say, Charlie, this is ridiculous. What's going on here?
Absolutely. Yeah. The channels of communication with Charlie or with race control, they're pretty much constant. So you on when you see the guy sitting there on the pit wall with 1,000 buttons in front of them, most of them are internal. So you can talk to different people on the pit wall. You can talk to race engineers. Again, certainly at Lotus, there was a rule with us that unless it was something very specific, only the race engineer would talk to the driver. But I certainly had a button I could override, and I could speak to the drivers if possible. And then amongst all of those buttons is a button to talk to Charlie or to talk to race control. And you use it constantly and you press it. I don't know what happens at the other end, because I've never been there, but I'm assuming in my brain that a little doorbell goes off or something. And then there's a queue system, and then Charlie will call you back when he's dealt with other people's queries and questions. So you press the button and it'll come back to you, and it can be anything. You could question. You could say there's some debris on the track. We could be asking him about if there's some damage on the car. Are we okay to leave it, or do you need us to come in and change it? So any one of a number of things. The difference, and to get to the question, in my opinion, is that Charlie, it's the best way to word it, he probably had a little bit more, I don't know if he had more respect or not, but in my opinion, it would seem as if there was a little bit more respect. I don't think...
For Charlie.
I don't think we would have ever spoken to Charlie the way that, for example, McLaren were talking to Massey. It was always more of a question. It was always more of a, you know, what do you think about this? Or can you give us some advice on that? And Charlie was a very, very gregarious person. He was great with all people. And I think he had a different way of approaching it. I don't know if you remember, do you remember Seb getting on the radio to him at the end of Mexico?
Yeah, Mexican Grand
calling
Prix,
him all the names under the sun. And that was why that was so shocking, because nobody spoke to Charlie like that. Charlie was like this, he was up on a pedestal. And and you asked him and you queried things, but I certainly don't think he would have been spoken to the way that the McLaren spoke. And I don't think he would be pushed around, is not the right word, but I think Massey maybe did what he did because of what McLaren said, and I'm not sure that's a precedent to set, a good precedent to set.
Well then, so you might agree with me that there might be a downside to having these messages publicly broadcast, because Massey's suddenly under pressure, and then and we're all human, pride kicks in, and then you're going to end up doubling down, or you lose face.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I'm trying to think of some of the things that we used to talk to Charlie about. As I say, you know, I came up with a few there, I think the tone with Charlie was very much more asking the questions, as opposed to what was broadcast. Certainly was more of a rant by McLaren, although they were very nice at the end of it.
I think
the final comment was, yeah, okay, fine, or whatever, however it was worded. But it goes on a lot. It's a regular occurrence. It happens all through practice, all through the race. As far as we were concerned at Lotus, you know, Charlie was the final, you know, the buck stops with him. So his decision was final.
I will say, I don't think the McLaren guys were overly disrespectful. I can see what you mean, that they were pushing their case, but it's a similar rule I have with the kids, which is like, watch for the tone. You can state your objection I will tell you I don't agree with you because you're tiny and stupid and don't know anything, then you can make your case, press it one more time. But if I then tell you that's the end of the argument, that's the end of the argument. And that's the kind of conversation that seemed to be going on there. But also, Michael Massey has not been in that role for as long as Charlie Whiting was. Obviously, Charlie Whiting, they used to film the driver's briefs, didn't they? They used to show parts from the driver's brief. And it was a very kind of, okay, guys, here's what to expect. I'm in charge. We're guessing here. Do you think Massey has that same kind of, you know, gravitas with the teams and drivers?
As you say, we're guessing because I never came across and encountered him. He seems like he does have a certain gravitas. Maybe not as much, or maybe you just earn it over being in the job for a number of years.
Yeah, it was very kind of teacher student. You know, a relationship. Charlie was talking to the students, like, you guys, you listen to me, this is what's happening. And they were all sat there, all like bored, playing games with each other, the naughty kids at the back mat.
Yeah, well, but it's important to remember that at the point at which we were seeing these briefings, he had been the guy for every single driver when they first graduated from GP2 or wherever it was they came to Formula One. Whereas Massey, he's walking into a job and people are remembering, you know, 10 years of briefings with Charlie and making that comparison. So it's a much different problem for him to solve.
Yeah.
And he's also, he's a referee at a massive international sporting event every other week or 3 weeks in a row coming up now. It's a very high pressure job. You have to wonder whether there should be race control and then like a referee, you know, like maybe instead of phoning up the race director, you should phone up like, you know, the driver steward.
He
can always pass the buck upwards, can't he? He can go, yeah, I messed up, and Massey can take control. Gives him another layer.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, the analogy is good. You know, he is like a referee that's looking after a group of unruly participants who are all trying to push the boundaries. You know, that's what they... I was going to say that's what they get paid for, but that's, you know, that competitive advantage is what every team is looking for.
So when you were talking about being on the pit wall and having those buttons, I could just see you hovering over Maldonado's button, coming, Pastor, the race car's very, very expensive. Just wanted to, me and the guys have been talking, just wanted to get that across to you. And that leads us to a brilliant listener question, Matt.
Yeah, in fact, it has been asked, how much does it really cost to fix one of these cars? And in particular, they were wondering about the Mercedes claim that it was £1 million crash.
Yeah.
For Bottas at Imola.
This was Jack Reeves that asked that question, Mr. Carter.
£1 million seems like a lot to me. I mean, I don't know. The car was fairly annihilated. I guess if they damaged the engine and the gearbox, as well as all of the bodywork on the car, then maybe you might get somewhere. No, even then, no, I don't know. Maybe Mercedes is made of pure gold or has got diamond encrusted bits in it. Maybe Lewis's steering wheel is diamond encrusted and it costs a bit more. I don't know. But certainly not for us. It was, you have to remember that cost is not, and I used to say this to people when they used to ask me, it's not the physical cost of the car. So when you say that front wing cost us £50,000, it's the research and the development and it's all the stuff behind it. So in my opinion, it's really difficult to put a price on them. That being said, you can pick up a rolling chassis for a few hundred thousand. So that's all the bodywork, but without an engine in it. So to say it cost them £1 million, I think is maybe a bit of an exaggeration. I know they were concerned about with the cost cap. I think they were concerned about where they're allowed to put employees and how that fits within the cost cap, and that maybe having to put some employees onto that weren't necessarily part of the F1 team would have been an issue. I don't know. But it seems like a lot to me. It's in an answer to the question. I think if you could say sort of each corner was maybe 100K, that would sort of give you a rough idea, maybe 400,000 or 500,000 if the car was a complete and utter write-off. But complete and utter write-off, the whole thing is very rare. You know, as you know, the cars are taken to pieces before every race and even between sessions, they're completely dismantled and then re-put back together.
Yeah, so it's a case of like the first wing might cost 20,000, but to do the second wing is like a couple of grand to just manufacture it. So normally it's a lot of the design costs.
Yeah, maybe not a couple of grand, but the analogy, yeah, okay, I get what you're saying. Yeah,
£18,000.
Not like a bumper on your road car, but yeah.
What pressure is the driver under? So Bradley Philpott has spoken to us about his fear when he goes into a race, because if he crashes, he has to pay the team a lot of the time. So a crash would cost him £20,000, for example, which on a normal person budget is horrendous. Like Yuki Tsunoda, you know, is he there? Is he having to worry about breaking his AlphaTauri?
No, not in the slightest.
Okay, but
that I think is obviously the difference when you get to F1. I mean, the minute they have to, they're worrying about things like that, then they're no longer a racing driver, or they're not racing for the right team. My opinion,
does it not come to a point where you have to sit someone down and go, actually, this is costing quite a lot, these continued crashes.
Not in such a black and white fashion, but certainly, and you know, I've sat down with Maldonado a few times, and both my drivers, I sat down with a few times and said, you know, we've only got one front wing, so it's going on Roman's car, and you know, because we had to test and evaluate it, and you know, I had the conversations with them whenever they were side by side on the grid, because they didn't like each other, you know, to make sure they stayed away from each other, which frequently they didn't. But yeah, I don't think it's a case of this is really expensive. The upgrades angle is usually a good one with drivers, because you're telling them, you know, we've got this upgrade, it's going to give us a few tenths of a second, but there's only so many of them. But that's more in practice than anything else. You're not telling them to back off in qualifying or the race. Maybe in practice you say, just take it easy, because we've only got one of these front wings and we're trying to evaluate it. But I think the minute you start telling them to back off in qualifying and the race, then you've kind of lost the point a little bit.
Very generous of you to say both my drivers. I'm just imagining that team brief. Right, guys, settle down. Now, we don't want to point any fingers, but that, like, you're staring at Pastor Maldonado, but we all as a team have to make sure that we don't use up our allocation of front wings. Stares again at Pastor Maldonado. Okay, you're saying nothing. quick one. You can't gloss over this. Like, I didn't realise that Roman Grosjean and Pastor Maldonado actively disliked each other beyond the normal team rivalry.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
Like,
I mean, they just didn't particularly get on. For a number of reasons, I think, that's the best way to put it. They're very different. They were very different entries into F1, shall we say.
Scene. Fair enough.
Different, you know, different ways of approaching the challenge of getting into F1. And maybe not necessarily one would believe that the other was the correct or the right way to do it. I dislike more than just lack of respect, maybe. I don't know. They certainly didn't get on, and they certainly didn't want the other one to beat them in the race at all.
Fair enough.
That was very, very obvious.
So, over the last few years where you've been coming on this show, you have spoken with a lot of fondness, admiration and respect for Roman Grosjean. And you have also mentioned the name Pastor Maldonado. But being someone who admired Roman Grosjean, you must be pretty happy. He's gone to IndyCar. And after a lot of, like, stick from F1 and that crash, he's done all right there. So just on a personal note, you must be chuffed.
Yeah. I mean, without wishing to alienate anyone, I'm not sure of the... Yes, I am very happy. Yes.
Oh,
he's good. No, he seems to be doing well.
Hospital pass there. You were going to tell Matt that IndyCar is rubbish and that the driver standards aren't the same.
Hang on, Marcus Ericsson won at the weekend.
Trumpets.
Well, yeah, only because Scott Dixon's ECU melted because he had to sit in the pit lane while all the cars came in before he was allowed to put a fan on his car. The extraordinary number of circumstances necessary for that to happen. And let's not forget, Pastor Maldonado won a race too. Now, did he not?
Oh, well.
Yes.
Yes, he did.
Yes, indeed.
Hey, listen, Pastor Maldonado, back to F1 for a minute, because I don't want to go over the landmines of IndyCar. Yeah, Pastor was a quick driver, and I've said that repeatedly. He was a very quick driver. Him on a one lap, when he was concentrating and focused, he and Roman would be very, 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 very close. And we all know that Roman was a quick race driver. Pastor's problem sometimes was stringing a number of laps together.
and maybe a bit of concentration. But certainly 2012 in Barcelona, he strung all the laps together and he won the race. So he was there on for a number of reasons, but he was certainly was talented. I would say that he was he could
we count those reasons?
There was lots of them, yeah.
Matt, during that conversation, yeah. I held you off a couple of times because I wanted to probe deeper into that inter-team relationship, but please feel free to fire off.
Well, we're talking about money, and I actually want to talk about money. I'm beginning to wonder, and is this a thing that you would think they would do, that Mercedes is beating the money gong a lot because of the cost cap coming in? I mean, you know, they're complaining about the cost of the sprint races, and they're complaining about the cost of the crashes. Is this just a way for them to pry more money back into their budget from the FIA?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's a classic F1 tactic. It's I don't necessarily believe that they have to do all those huge measures, but I think what they're trying to do is to say to the outside world, you know, this is not F1 as you're used to watching it, and we're restricted in what we can do because of this cost cap, and it's not good for the sport. But they can't say it so directly, so they're saying it in ways that they believe are going to get hit home, and make people stop and say, hang on a minute, if Mercedes can't afford to repair a car, then what chance have everyone else got? I heap a fair amount of skepticism on the fact that they genuinely believe that that's an issue. But then they've got a lot of staff. They've got an awful amount of staff. They need to lay off some staff to get down to that budget cap. And, you know, how they do that is going to be tricky. You know, there's a cost to doing that.
Right. So the question I have for you then is that we know that the new wing standard, the wing test, the static wing test, rear wing test, starts this week in Paul Ricard. We know that Mercedes threatened to file a protest if they felt like Red Bull or other teams were taking advantage of the updated regulations, yet they did not. So you're a team boss. Can you give me a ballpark? What would it cost to file a protest like that? And if you went to appeals, what might that cost as well? I mean, what would Mercedes have been on the hook for had they decided to follow through for it? And do you think that might have been part of the reason they didn't?
Again, possibly. We never filed a protest. It doesn't cost anything to file the protests. It costs, obviously, our lovely friends in the legal profession. It costs them. And the appeal is held, as far as I'm aware, the appeal is held in the High Court. So therefore, you have to have barristers. And it's the legal side of it that costs money. In terms of a number to put on it, it depends how many days. It depends on the intensity of the appeal. But you're certainly looking into a few hundred thousand, I would have thought, for them to make an appeal. And is it worthwhile doing? They'll have pointed it out on numerous occasions to the FIA. And they try and leave them to make the decision. And maybe, you know, if the FIA don't make the decision, then they maybe will take a step back and say, well, hang on a minute, you know, if they're not prepared to do it, why should we do it? It's done for political reasons. It's done to upset the opponent. It's done to take people off their A game. It's done to divert resources away from, you know, making the car go faster into dealing with, issues. So there's lots at play. It's just a massive political game, Formula One, as we all know, and how you play it and how you get out the other side of it is kind of whether you're successful or not, rightly or wrongly.
All right. Okay. I think time for another. No, did you have more, Matt?
Often render you both completely silent. I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
No, I think I know what I want to ask about next, but it sounds like we should have a listener question first.
If you've got something that flows from that, Trumpets, you crack on.
Well, in fact, I do. We have a new partner for Mercedes, Ineos, and I was under the impression you might know something more than we do about this deal.
I'm really confused about this deal. Like, they've sold a bit of the Mercedes team to the title sponsor, Ineos. Is that exciting to you?
Potentially going forward, yeah. They haven't sold a bit. They've sold a third. So Mercedes, well, this was a while ago. So Mercedes is a third Daimler, which is Mercedes, a third Toto, and a third.
Are you mocking Kyle Power by saying that? That's an amazing. Right? Are you mocking Kyle Power by saying Toto?
Absolutely not.
Fantastic.
As if I would do such a thing.
You would.
So it's a third. It's a third Toto, a third Ineos, and a third Daimler. What was your question? Why is this relevant? I mean, it's relevant if the team's no longer called Mercedes next year.
Next year,
or the year after.
Which one is?
Wait a minute. Yeah, more, please.
Yes.
Yeah, elaborate.
Yeah, all I'm saying is that would make it relevant, I think, is all I'm saying.
Okay, so let's bring this back a second. Do Mercedes want to have a Mercedes AMG Petronas F1 team going forward, in your opinion?
In my humble opinion?
In your humble, wild, speculative opinion.
I think they probably do. But I think there's probably some caveats to that.
I don't understand, Matt. What language is he speaking? Unpick this for me.
Latin. He's speaking Latin because he wants to obfuscate. What would those caveats be? If you were in Mercedes' shoes, what caveats would you want to put on your continued participation?
The world of road cars, as we all know, is going in a certain direction. And that direction isn't necessarily petrol-powered. Mercedes-Benz have entered into another racing series where the cars might be powered by electricity, maybe. And maybe they are looking to see how best they sell road cars. Is that through promoting their brand in a Formula One race, or is it through promoting brand somewhere else? They've just entered Formula E, and they are putting a certain amount of time, effort, and resource into that. They've ticked all the boxes in F1, and they're doing very, very well. They're producing good road cars, they're selling nice road cars, but you know, the world is the world of road cars is going electric, and the relevance to Formula One maybe is something that they're questioning. There's much talk, much more than there ever has been before, from Stefano Domenicali about carbon neutral fuels, the amount of electricity that's going to be used going forward, et cetera, et cetera. So I think they are taking stock of the situation. And I think that we have to just respect the fact that they are there to sell cars. You know, that's Mercedes-Benz's job. So they're not there to have the fastest race car. They're not there to have 8 times, 10 times world champions. They're there to sell cars. And they're going to do that in the best way that suits them as a company. And if that means that they relinquish some of their control over their F1 team, then so be it. I think they'll continue to supply the engines to a number of teams on the grid, and they'll continue to be very much involved in F1. But it's a business decision, and it's based on how they best market and sell their cars.
Yeah, the road relevance thing. I mean, more and more now, the argument is not if, but it is when. The UK government has moved forward plans to ban the sale of new fossil fuel cars. So that's now 2030, I think, you won't be able to buy a new petrol or diesel car, all electric. So that road relevance thing is starting to come more and more to the fore. So let me get this straight. Did you say a third Ineos, a third Wolf, and a third Daimler? Was that where we're sitting now, Matt?
There's also the small matter of the $128 million sponsorship that saw Ineos called the principal partner of Mercedes in the team as well.
So what do you think then, Mr. Carter, for 2022/2023? What are we talking here? Potentially Wolf Ineos F1.
Wolf Ineos, George Russell, Esteban Ocon, Lewis Hamilton at Ferrari.
Oh, what are you doing? Now you're just messing with me. So yes, I'm going to take that as a yes. 2022.
I don't know. I genuinely don't know. I think, and I don't think anyone knows. I don't think Mercedes know just yet. I think they are assessing their options. But they've certainly, you know, I've said Mercedes-Benz told our friend Mr. Wolf that they didn't want to be putting money into the team going forward. They wanted the team to be cash neutral.
Yeah.
And that was one of the reasons that the deal with Ineos came about, and the deal with Ineos, as far as I'm aware, Jim Ratcliffe, the guy that runs Ineos, was very much, you know, I will do this, but I want some shares in the team. He's known for that, or Ineos are known for that. They have shares in a number of other sporting franchises. Whether they decide to increase, Toto decides to increase, or Mercedes decrease, is all up in the air as far as I'm aware. You have to remember how much that terrible pandemic has affected things. You know, if we were in a normal world in normal times, then maybe they wouldn't be thinking that, but maybe they've been sort of forced into a slightly different position. Cost cap doesn't help Mercedes-Benz because it reduces the ability for them to differentiate themselves by using money. And you have to be cognizant of that, that, you know, they can no longer throw money at the problem and be the fastest team, which they've done before. So maybe the fact that it's going to be a bit more of a level playing field will scare them off a little bit. It's all up for discussion.
Excellent. Just want to answer F1 fan 89 in the chat. Over 90% of the entire world's cars are still ICEs, but I guess we're just going to ignore that. It's the new cars. It's the new car sales that Mercedes are interested in. And increasingly, those will be EVs, electric vehicles as well. Normally on this show, I object to people insisting on saying things in the foreign tongue's accent, even if you're English. So I do sometimes object to Leclerc and the Bahrain Grand Prix. However, Matt, when it comes to Wolf Racing, I will insist that everyone on the panel say Wolf Racing, Wolf Ineos Racing. You will have to say it like that.
Fair. Everyone will do their best. Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Wolf Racing. I like it. All right. Brilliant. I've got some Mercedes related questions here, actually. John M's got a good one. But first, I think drivers, Matt. Drivers. What do we think we know? Let's go to Mr. Carter. George Russell. We thought that George Russell, well, this is Chris Stevens. This is Chris Stevens bowling in with a source. Right. Oh, no, I shouldn't have said, should I? Chris Stevens definitely didn't tell us anything.
Wild speculation.
But he was talking about Russell
I've forgotten how bizarre some of these conversations
are. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, it's just like they wanted to get into trouble. But Chris came to us and said, look, I've heard on my grapevine, Russell signed a contract at Mercedes, no real further details. Apparently, there's something that Joe has been whispering about, but I've not quite caught that. Also, like F1, Williams supporters. A few people are now really pushing this George Russell has signed a contract. Planet F1, I think, had it today that at Silverstone, they're going to announce that Russell is taking his place for next season. A, do you know anything about it? B, do you think that's a good idea?
I don't know any specifics. I've been saying on here for a long time now that I think that Russell's future is at Mercedes. And it was all a case of timing. I think, again, without bashing the same drum, I think if COVID hadn't happened, I think he potentially would have been in there at the start of this season. I think COVID just made everyone just sort of pause and take reflection on things. I have no further details. I'll go with it. I'm 100% sure that he'll end up there at some point. I think it depends on, I was going to say on Bottas's performances. So you can draw your own conclusions there. And it also depends on what Lewis wants to do or how much Lewis stands his ground in terms of his salary requirements. That's the reason that he's on a one-year deal is because Mercedes are not convinced that it's sustainable going forward, paying him that amount of money. So I don't know. There's a lot of things up in the air. You know, if Lewis doesn't win the championship this year, is he going to hang around and take a pay cut to try and go for the eighth to take over for Michael Schumacher? Possibly. In that case, it would be him and Russell, I would say. Lewis has a say over his partner, over his teammate.
You think? How? Really?
Yes. I thought that was common knowledge, isn't it?
No, not to me, but I don't pay a lot of attention. Like, I don't know. Well, the common thing from Hamilton fans, we would want to think that Lewis Hamilton will just take all comers. And I think in his younger career, that may well have been true. But when you get to 36, 37, you've won seven and you're getting a little bit old. To be fair, he probably has lost ultimate pace. It would be smart to have it in your contract that you have some say on a teammate. I just didn't know that was the case.
Yeah, he was consulted before they re-signed Bottas. Nice. Should we just leave it at that?
That is fascinating. I'm hearing sometimes from some, I keep on seeing that there might be driver salary caps in the future. Have you heard anything about that? And might that have something to do with his decision?
I mean, I haven't heard, but that makes absolute sense because, again, you know, I've said before, the cost cap's great, but if they exclude the cost cap as it stands today, to me, is a vehicle to make a proper cost cap. You know, they've got the idea of a cost cap across. They've got the teams to participate in this, believing that there is a cost cap. But in reality, the cost cap that is in position as of today is a joke because, you know, the top five salaries of your best employees, your driver's salaries, logistics are out of it, marketing's out of it. You know, I think we've run the numbers before on here, and if you start to add all those things in, you get back up to where if Mercedes-Benz were spending 300 before, and they're now limited to 145, Lewis is on 40 million, and Valtteri's on 5, and Toto's on 5, and the other senior management are on 5 between them. Logistics cost 20. You suddenly get back up to almost 300. So, it would make sense to put drivers' salaries in there. But the drivers are obviously going to complain about that. They're not going to be happy about it. Well, I say the drivers, there's probably only two or three that are going to be affected. And again, I think I said on here before that in my opinion, aside from Lewis's 1 year contract, I think Verstappen and Leclerc's deals were the last big deals that are going to be signed in F1 in terms of money.
Yeah, I remember you saying that. And would then the drivers start looking at sponsorship perhaps to boost that and say, well, okay, well, in that case, let me sell Verstappen trainers.
There will be, you know, in other sports, image rights come into play. You know, there's always ways around these things. So yeah, maybe Lewis will get 20 million from the team and then he'll be able to, he'll get image rights and you can move that aside from the salary and you can pull that outside the cost cap. So there's clever and interesting ways around all these things, and it's up to the FIA to have someone there to try and stop the teams from abusing them.
So I wonder then if the reports that Lewis Hamilton might well be willing to take a pay cut to continue at Mercedes, like it could just be like that's your basic salary cut, but other things are coming in because yeah, well that's what the internet is saying. I just can't imagine them not coming to a conclusion where Lewis Hamilton stays on if he wants to at the moment. I can't see that there's like a move to get rid of him and replace him right now, despite the Russell move. I don't think that's
that. What makes you think that?
Well, I just don't think that they're saying now, right, we're going to sign George Russell. He's out. This is the end of the Hamilton era. So like it or lump it. I think this is, they're looking for kind of a peaceful transfer of power.
But why, and I'm not being precocious, but why do you think that? You think that because Lewis is important to the team?
In
terms of winning races or in terms of as a public figure or in terms of marketing? What do you mean?
I just think that they understand that they've got the champ, that is good to have the champ at your team, and the fact that he probably does sell a fair few T-shirts.
I'm going to say winning races 100%. And I'm just going to posit that there will be a tear in the corner of the eye of Derek in marketing the day Lewis Hamilton walks out the door at Mercedes.
Well, that's the point. And you know, you've hit the nail on the head, Matt. That is the point. From a marketing point of view, from a selling T-shirts, from a marketing Mercedes, then Lewis is gold dust. But there's a price to that. There's a finite price to that marketing appeal. In terms of winning races, again, I'm going to upset you, but there's an argument to say that George Russell could come in there and do a similar job.
He can win races.
I know Valtteri's not necessarily proving that in the second car, but yeah, there's an argument to say that if Mercedes are there to win a championship or to certainly be at a front running team, then they can do that with George Russell and another driver who are very competent drivers. But in terms of marketing and how much value they put on that, then there's a huge amount. And it's my belief that that's the reason that Lewis got the deal that he got for this 1 year. But it has, you know, that there's got to be a drop dead date. And will Lewis take a pay cut? I mean, does anyone like to take a pay cut? I know he's got more money than God, but does, you know, nobody likes to take a pay cut, and he's got plenty of other things to do. In my opinion, with the thing with Lewis really depends on whether he wins the championship this year.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the key. And it's not quite so black and white, but if he wins, he leaves. If he doesn't, he stays. You know, it's that kind of a deal. And I think that's what they're, in my opinion, I think that's what they're waiting for.
Okay. So let's say he wins. Let's say he leaves. Who's at Mercedes? Does Valtteri suddenly stay now and Russell comes in? Or is it a double driver swap? What do you think is going to... Let's give you that hypothetical.
Ooh, I like that.
How team many like times what do, we do? Do I have to say that Ocon. Russell and Ocon will be in that team at some point? Now, I've said it maybe a little bit premature.
Okay.
I can blame lots of things like a global pandemic for affecting that that timeline. I could waffle on about lots of different things. Now, it's my opinion that there's a reason that Ocon wasn't released from his Mercedes contract, and which he's still under at Renault, as we know. And there's a reason that, you know, they've got George in the wings. And those two would be great drivers. They would be great ambassadors. They would do a good job. You know, Ocon is a very quick driver. You know, he's not always had the best of equipment underneath him, but he's a quick driver. I know that may be a little bit contentious, but I think that he and Russell will be the two that end up there. And I don't think someone like Max going to Mercedes is necessarily going to work. I don't think that that is a, in my opinion, I don't think that's a fit.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Oh, we've got quite a few scenarios there. Okay, let's roll it back. I'm really pleased Matt did that scenario of like Hamilton wins and he leaves. Because I think Bottas is done. I think certainly we've heard that there was tensions at Mercedes with Bottas storming out. You don't have to believe me, I don't care. But we heard that from the shop floor that Bottas stormed out of a meeting, and this was like a couple of months back now, or maybe a month ago after the clash with George Russell. So in all scenarios, I think we all agree that Bottas is probably done. So scenario A is that George Russell is up against Lewis Hamilton next season. I wonder how that team dynamic works. If it is just free to fire, off you go, still fancy Lewis, Matt, here we go. I still fancy Lewis Hamilton wins over the course of a season, not necessarily on pace, not necessarily on outright speed, but I just think Lewis Hamilton has been there, done that. It will be tough for Russell. It will be tough for Russell to go up against Lewis Hamilton. Lewis Hamilton is getting older. At some point, there's the crossover. But next year, I still think Lewis Hamilton will take George Russell in a title fight.
I don't think that's even a question, considering the fact that Russell will be moving to a new team. And I tend to be more guarded about his prospects immediately on the team, because as we've all seen, when you change teams, there is a cost to you as a driver. You are at a severe disadvantage, particularly if you're competing against someone who's been at that team for a long time. And finally, I know Russell's performance in the desert was everything. But let's also remember that was at a track that had like, what, 3.5 corners?
And also people need to kind of remember a little bit that Russell was actually struggling that weekend. And when he was up against Bottas in his strong bit of his weekend, which is practice qualifying, Russell did look like second best when it came to race pace. If you get ahead of Bottas, he's unlikely to attack you on track. That's kind of been his MO. So I think the Russell could easily do things well based on his Shakir Grand Prix performance. Is just a little bit previous. But what do you think of that team dynamic, Mr. Carter? Do you think I'm being too ham-fossy?
Short answer, yes.
Fair enough.
Slightly longer answer. My opinion and my belief about Russell is not based on the Sakhir Grand Prix, even remotely. It's based on him and it's based on what the team have seen from him. Him moving to another team is not quite the same as other people. They talk a lot. They talk a lot about Ricciardo's issues being the fact that he's always driven a Renault engine and he's now with a Mercedes and it's difficult to get used to, and that drivers. So you have to remember George Russell is driving a Mercedes engine.
Yeah.
And has been for a number of seasons. He's also their test and reserve driver. He's also their sim driver. He also works with the team. He knows the engineers. All of those things are some of the reasons why drivers maybe have a little bit of a period where they break in when they go to a new team. So I think you can dismiss some of those. And I don't think you can overestimate the talent that the kid's got. He's dragging a less than optimal, should we say in Ron Dennis terms, a less than optimal car. And he's regularly getting it out of Q3. My belief about George is not based on, as I say, it's not based on his performance for that one race. It's based on what I hear and I know. And I think that he is what Toto thinks is the future for that team. I think he genuinely sees that. Remember now, Toto is a 33% shareholder. So financial decisions impact on him. And the difference between Lewis and George Russell in terms of salary is enormous, is a title sponsor in terms of the figures. So I think Bottas is going back to Williams. I think George is coming to Mercedes. I think who George partners up with depends on what happens this season. And I think Lewis will potentially have a say in that. How much of it, I don't know. I know that that's another one of the sticking points into why he didn't extend his contract until late in the day.
That is interesting. And Lucas makes a good point in the chat room, Matt, that next year the cars are changing for everyone, not just those who are changing teams.
Yeah,
absolutely. And,
it's a big change. But let me ask you about this then. I've also seen rumors that Alpine, are suddenly, after watching Ocon against Alonso, kind of much more keen maybe to keep him on. How does that complicate where Mercedes is if they're not sure if Hamilton's going to stay or not? What's going to happen? Because I'm seeing that it might be announced to Paul Ricard that he's staying with Renault. So Have you heard anything? I know you know people more than we do.
I do know people. The decision is all Mercedes. Ocon is a Mercedes driver, so it's their decision. So if they decide they want to pull him back, then they pull him back. In Ocon can't change that, and neither can Alpine. Alpine have seen that he's a good driver. They can see his quality, and we can argue till we're blue in the face, but I believe that Ocon has got a real natural talent and a gift, and he's still learning his trade. And he learned a lot from Sergio in terms of tire management. And I think some of that's being borne out now as well. But ultimately, it's Mercedes' decision. And, it's classic driver market silly season, isn't it? It's all the dominoes have to fall into place at the right time. So it's Mercedes' decision. It depends a lot on what happens with Bottas. I can't see Bottas in that Mercedes next season. I really don't think that's going to happen. And I don't know about the storming out of meetings and all that stuff. It's little things that I've heard behind the scenes, and I just don't think he's going to be there. And therefore, it comes down to George and who. And I think
as I said before, that comes down to Lewis can make that decision. And I believe it'll be based on whether he wins the title or not.
Right. Well, I'm pretty Ocon-fosy. So if Lewis is not there, you're making me happy when you say things like that. But what, pray tell, might you have heard? Like what has set your little spidey sense tingling there? Just curious. Not trying to get you to reveal any things you're not supposed to reveal. No, I would never do that.
No, I'm not. I'm for once, I'm not actually not revealing anything.
I've done it all wrong, Spanners.
The Ocon stuff is factual. You know, he is still a Mercedes driver. They didn't release him. They didn't say to Renault wanted him at the time. They wanted to take him and Mercedes wouldn't release him. And that's because in my opinion, I don't think there's necessarily a lot of young Mercedes drivers that are going to fit the bill. So that's why, you know, Lando is pretty much stuck, that's a horrible way to say it, but Lando is going to be at McLaren for the long term. And I think McLaren quite rightly are going to build their team around him. He's got a long-term deal there. Leclerc's got a long-term deal at Ferrari. Max is going to stay at Red Bull. So what options have Mercedes got really? They're not going to promote a completely unknown talent. So they've got if we assume Bottas is out and they've got Russell, then it really falls down to that other seat and Lewis's decision in terms of whether he wins or not and in terms of what demands he's going to have for his salary.
Excellent. EJ in the live chat here, who, by the way, is helping us out moderating our live chat. Thank you very much for that. If you want to join our live chat, search for Missed Apex Podcast on YouTube and you can like and subscribe. I have to say that. I'm a YouTuber, as much as I wouldn't want to admit. I'm a YouTuber. Like and subscribe, guys. Also, I am a TikToker, I guess now. We have a TikTok account where we're putting clips of the show to TikTok. So I'm basically definitely young and sexy still. And if you want to follow us on Twitter, it's at MissedApexF1. EJ says, hang on. I've lost it. I've lost his comment after all that waffle. Here we go. Kyle Power can now brag that he has been mocked for 60 minutes by an F1 team boss. I find that absolutely wonderful. I know you do listen to Missed Apex while you're off on your country jogs and you've taken time out of this interview to mock Kyle Power. I appreciate that more than you could know, Mr. Carter. Okay, we've got a question from John M that I wanted to get to, and this is a team boss related question. In the context of Mercedes and how Toto's public statements have recently changed, how do you decide as a team principal what tone and manner of talking about your challenges as a team and the mistakes you've made when do you pitch when you are facing the press? So like Toto is very much, this is a disaster, we cannot make any excuses, Derek is the one responsible for this, and just like and Christian Horner said Toto throws his team under the bus. And I have to say, Christian Horner, very much, he's very different. He never seems to do that thing where he goes, this is terrible. He always goes, it was definitely somebody else's fault. That's Horner's approach, isn't it? All the time. It was definitely someone else's fault. How do you pitch that?
What's the question? How do I pitch talking to the media? It honestly really depends on what's going on at the time. And you know, I have to say that I was in the firing line regularly because of all sorts of things that weren't necessarily going on the track. So there's Toto and Christian are obviously much more adept than I was. They've got media people behind them that are advising them what they should and shouldn't say, obviously. And they're going to pick and choose the tone. They're good at manipulating the press as far as I'm concerned. It depends what they're trying to achieve. They've 9 times out of 10, they've got an end goal that they're trying to get to. And whether or not that is to blame the team or to not blame the team or to put pressure on the people back at the factory. I was never unfortunately in charge of a front running team. So my woes and my worries were very different to Christian and Toto's. But yeah, they've got different ways of approaching it. Toto's is much better. It is what it is. It's
With the reflection of time, like you were very much thrown into the lion's den, and it wasn't your background to be like a media facing sports entity. Like over the years now, do you look back and you go, I should have told them all to bug off. I should have said it was all Caterham's fault.
I don't look back with those specific thoughts.
No,
but, you know, sometimes I do look back and think, you know, we could have done things differently. But
no, I mean your specific media kind of game.
Yeah, I mean overall, I like to think that I played it fairly straight. I mean, there's a reason that Joe Saywood and I talk to each other. You know, there's you know, some team bosses and journalists really don't get on, and you know, I try to be fairly as straight as I could be without demoralizing the team or without throwing the team under the bus.
There we go.
I don't know. It's a game of cat and mouse with the media. It always has been and always will be. It, you know, I learned a hell of a lot very quickly. I learned that, and again, you know, you guys are journalists, but you know, that the person that writes the headlines is not necessarily the person that's written the article. I found that out very quickly because I think it was Andrew Benson. I can't remember. I gave someone an interview, and the headline that came out was something about Maldonado not necessarily being there the next season. And, you know, the guys from Venezuela rang me immediately. And what did you say this for? And if you read the article, I never said that. But I had a bit of a go at Andrew Benson, and he said, look, I don't write the headlines. You know, the headlines are there for clickbait. And so you learn all these things, and I learned them very quickly. Toto and Christian are very seasoned in what they do. I think you have to look at all of those interactions with the media. And as I do, you have to assume that there is an underlying purpose behind what they're saying. And certainly when it's specific like that, there's an underlying reason behind what they're saying.
Title of this episode, Carter Death Stare Made Maldonado Fearful of Crashes. That's what we're going for this episode. But there's a couple of kind of coach style interview techniques, whereas Horner is kind of top cover for his whole team. Toto Wolff doesn't mind just being a bit more broad, you know. So Horner is a bit more kind of fortress mentality. It's his team against the press, whereas Toto is like, yeah, no, I'm with you. I see all the faults. I see the flaws. This is where we have to improve. And a lot of the times when he does that, he ends up almost accidentally singling out people. So if he says we were poor in this department, poor old Derek, head of that department, is like, oh, boss has had a go at me there.
Yeah, but that's management style 101.
And yes.
It depends what your specific management style is and how you best feel that you can motivate your team. Again, there's a thousand ways to word it, carrot and stick, or,
yeah,
you know, it's management style 101. And I'm not going to sit here and cast aspersions on either of their management styles. They're not necessarily my management style. You know, I tend to believe in sort of positive affirmation. And that's always worked for me. You know, different strokes for different folks, I guess. And hang on a minute. I cannot sit here and say that either Christian or Toto are doing anything wrong. Because they're supremely successful in what they do. Well, Christian hasn't been for a number of years, when technically he probably should have been. But, you know, that being said, with the money that he's paid and, you know, the team that he's got there and the drivers that he's got, he probably should have achieved a bit more than he has done. But that's a different subject.
Okay, show me on this doll where Christian Horner hurt you. Trumpets, you had a question.
Yeah, I did, because now I'm absolutely loving this. And I know we're just talking about Horner and Wolff and how they deal with the media.
Wolff.
But Wolff. Was that acceptable?
Dankeschön.
It is it. Who, if you suddenly were a billionaire with a Formula One team, of the current team principals, people running teams, who would you want to come in and be the team principal that built your team? I'm just like curious as to your evaluation. Doesn't mean that one person is better than the other, but the way you like to manage things, who would you pick to come run your Formula One team?
Nice.
Well, I Toto, I think is the answer. Aside from Toto, the other team principals,
I don't particularly have a hell of a lot of respect for any of the others aside from Toto, to be perfectly honest. There is, I don't even know who the team principal is at Alpine at the moment. Who is the official team principal at Alpine?
I know Brivio went there, but I'm trying to remember. They got the FX de Maison as the technical guy, and his boss formerly at VW Motorsport, I think, is sort of the team principal now, but I can't recall his name off the top of my head.
Okay, it's okay. The chat room will rescue us. In the meantime, sure. I am going...
Oh, actually, Seidel. I've got a bit of respect for Seidel. I think he's doing a good job, but no respect for Zach Brown. Aside from that, I think Toto is the answer. I think Christian's good. Christian is a good team principal when things are going his way. And I think when things aren't going his way, then there are certain weaknesses in the way that he approaches what he does and how he does it. And again, I was being a little bit facetious before, but which I know is unlike me, but he has had all the money in the world and the best driver talent. And he hasn't really delivered, as far as I'm concerned, in the hybrid era. You know, he can blame Renault as much as he wants. He can then blame Honda. He can blame all those things. But ultimately, he could and should, I believe, or the team could and should have done better than it has done.
Oh, my God.
Since 2014.
Mr. Carter, chat room's kicking off now. Some people are saying Budkowski. Other people are saying that's not.
Oh, yeah. It is Budkowski.
People are saying no respect for Zach Brown, no respect for Capito. What's he on about?
Well, Capito was brought in and Zach Brown kicked him back out again. So Capito came into McLaren as one of Ron Dennis's signings. And I don't even think he did a day. He was straight back out again. So they don't have respect for each other. Zach Brown is, I don't know. I just, to me, he comes across more of a, more of a fan than a team principal. I think I don't necessarily agree with the way that he's approached a lot of what he's done.
And he's not team principal.
That being said,
to be fair,
McLaren is obviously doing very well for itself. It's on the right track. Helped, I'm sure, in part by the engine. They're doing something right. But I think it's more down to Seidel than it is to Zach.
Thank you to Stuart Neal for providing the real show title, which is Carter Calls for Horner's Head. That is definitely the title of this episode. Also, Seidel, he does seem competent. You would not want him to give your best man speech at your wedding, would you? That's not...
Oh, yeah, he's got no personality, yeah. But he's competent at what he's doing.
Yeah.
I mean, he's he had a I think he's doing a good job. I think he, more than anyone else, is the one that has put that team back on the right track. And it's an interesting conundrum, that whole team. You know, it's the Ron Dennis era, the, you know, everything that came with that. You know, the Mansour OJ, Ron Dennis fallout and all those things. So
is that going to affect McLaren going forward? Because he was the money man. At the end of the day, he was the one who won the battle with Dennis.
Yeah.
For McLaren. Now he's gone. Is that potentially a financial issue for them?
He bought McLaren as a vehicle to sell aeroplanes. That was the reason that he bought McLaren. His business essentially is to sell private jets, and he realized that. And I found this out the other day. He realized that he was buying so many watches as incentives to rich people to buy private jets that he should just buy Hoyer and rename it Tag Hoyer. So Tag was his company. So Tag was the aircraft company. So he bought Hoyer just because he was buying so many watches. So he bought Tag Hoyer. And then he bought Moët & Chandon because he was giving away so much champagne. So he bought the company Moët & Chandon. And he was a title sponsor at Williams. And he bought McLaren because it was a good way to sell private jets. You know, to introduce the rich and the famous into places that they'd never been before. And that was why he bought it. So, but he was... I only met him a couple of times, but he was a lovely guy, as everyone said in the last few weeks. And will it make any difference to McLaren going forward? I think he'd already, he did what he did with Ron.
and it was very pointed and it was done for a reason. And then obviously he's been in ill health for a while. So I don't think it's going to affect the business going forward. Tag as a company advanced them a big chunk of money during COVID times to keep them on the straight and narrow. I don't think it'll affect the company going forward, no.
I'm just thinking I chose the wrong profession. I should have been in a profession where I could just buy champagne companies and watch companies to further my business.
Yeah, man.
I agree.
Do you want in, Mr. Carter? I've been thinking about starting a hammock business because I'm so in. We're now a two hammock family. And that's why I'm thinking we're going into Mist Apex branded hammocks. That's my next thing. First offer. You're the first dragon that I'm offering Mist Apex hammocks to. Are you in or out?
I'm out.
Oh, man. Okay, in that case, I'll go to a listener question. Kevin or Zoko, are you okay for time, Mr. Carter? Are you okay for
the I'm good. Yeah, okay, I'm good. It's the end, to be honest, it's the end of the day here, so I'm winding down.
Yeah, and I'm so sweaty and drunk now that to me, time is meaningless. Kevin asks, please ask Mr. Carter, what would you do as a hypothetical consultant to the Haas F1 team? Because I have to be honest with you, I don't know what Haas is anymore. They came in with such good intentions. They were clever with their relationship with Ferrari. They seemed to be clever delaying for a season. That was a bold decision at all. And you felt like this was like Gene Haas going all in. But now I don't know. Where's the soul? It feels like there's no soul to Haas F1 right now. What would you do as the consultant to that team?
Blimey. That's a it's a loaded question, isn't it? I don't know. You kind of answered it with the question itself. There is no soul, or there doesn't seem to be certainly a lack of purpose in the last season or so. Their deal with Ferrari, from my understanding, was a 5-year deal. So that must be coming to an end this season. I don't know if they've extended or what they've done. I don't know. I think Gene Haas has fallen out of love with the sport of F1 personally.
Right.
I don't think he likes the fact that they're toiling around at the back.
Well, that's huge.
We spoke before about the two young drivers was a disastrous decision. And I get why they did it. But there's no reference point there. There hasn't been a reference point there this season, and it's not going to help them to develop that car or to move forward. They talk very publicly about they're putting everything into next year's car. So I guess we have to sit and wait and see. If I was a consultant and I went in there and I saw all the books and the numbers and what they were doing, then there's a decision to make. And if they are really putting everything into next year, then so be it. You've got to take that with all the good intentions that it's meant, and believe that they're putting time and effort into next year's car, and they'll be more competitive. I don't know.
I don't see any faith. That's quite an optimistic take. Sorry, Matt. As an American, it's got to hurt. Like this was the big US team, and if we're really going to court like American viewers into F1, then we Haas F1. Being at least, say, where McLaren or Aston Martin are, would have been a huge boon for that. Haas F1 with an American driver at some point fighting for points. That would have been amazing for what F1's trying to do.
Absolutely would have been amazing. And let's not forget that they came into the sport and they were there.
Yep.
In fact, of all the new teams who came into the sport over the last decade, they are the only ones that actually made any kind of a serious go at it. That weren't bought from previous teams. They were brand new team. And I think were it not for the change in regulations in 2017, they probably still would be making a go of it. But they got that year wrong. And that, I think, was enough to put Haas off of it. And ever since then, I think Steiner has just been making promises and doing what he has to do to keep the lights on.
Yeah, I agree.
Hoping for something good to happen. The good news is maybe next year's Ferrari power unit puts them back in a place where they can be more competitive.
Well, yeah, I mean, and that's the point. I think they were where they were because of there was a lot of discussion when they first came into the sport as to Ferrari bending the rules in terms of wind tunnel time. And there was rumors within F1 of Ferrari guys changing their t-shirts to Haas t-shirts and then doing another run in the wind tunnel so that they could. So there was lots of help they were getting from Ferrari in the early days. And it was a way for Ferrari to try and get back on pace with Mercedes, which they did to an extent. And there's, you know, it's a whole nother raft of an argument, but that Ferrari maybe should have won a championship, that Vettel maybe should have beaten Hamilton at some point. So maybe it worked. And then maybe Ferrari took a step back and they stopped giving as much time, effort and development tokens, if you like, to Haas. So I think they're going to be there. I think they are a saleable team, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
If Mazepin buys into it, then so be it. And then your further question about the American angle. I read an article, I think it was on the BBC website, with Stefano Domenicali, where it's quite interesting. If you read between the lines a little bit, he's basically saying that he's not approaching this job in the same way as Chase Carey. And I think one of the quotes in there is about the number of races, saying that Chase was always striving for 25 races a year. And Stefano saying that's not just a blind target that we're shooting for. We need to be a bit more specific and a bit more tactical about this. So as long as the races are in the right continent and as long as the races make sense, then so be it. But we're certainly not just going to say we want to hit 25. It's got to be done for the right reasons. And I think to the same extent, maybe, you know, Stefano's got more of F1 in him than Chase had, and maybe they won't do as much of a push for the US market. I, you know, it's all a little bit up in the air at the moment. And Haas it would be a great story. I don't think Gunter's the right guy to do what he's doing.
Why?
But he was there for a very specific reason.
Why isn't Gunter the right guy?
He's not very good.
Why? Why isn't he very good?
I couldn't possibly comment. I just don't necessarily think he's a particular. Listen, to be a team principal, a team boss is. But just for the record, I'm not saying that I was in any way, shape, or form any good at it. I was learning on the job.
Yeah,
I was
granted.
Making. I nearly swore there. Stuff up as I was going along. So I'm by no means saying that
sure.
I in any way would do a better job. That being said, I don't think that Gunter's style of management fits with an F1 team. I think he's a little bit divisive. He's trying to, I think you see it in Drive to Survive. I mean, I saw it firsthand a little bit, but I think you see it in Drive to Survive. He very much sort of, was there not a bit in Drive to Survive where he didn't invite Romain Grosjean to a team party or something like that because there'd been an accident or, so I don't know. I just think he's a little bit too divisive. I think it's a very specific job and you need to be very cognizant of the fact that you bring everyone together and that it is a team. It's really easy to have two sides of the garage fighting against each other. You know, you've got two different sets of mechanics and they're vying for their own individual driver, and having those individual mechanics pulling for the team it's a tricky thing to do. It's because you need to instill competition, but you also need to make sure that they work together. So competition amongst both sides of the garage, but also make sure that they work together. And all of that is going to drive the team forward. And we've talked already, you know, in the last hour or so, you know, Christian and Toto have got very different approaches to it. I'm not saying one's right and one's wrong, but Toto's is right. I just don't see that there's a lot of guys in those positions, certainly now, that Cyril was not a great team person, and I think that showed, and I think it was reflected in some of the decisions he made and some of the things that happened. And again, for the amount of money that Renault threw into that team, and from the broad bones, the backbone, or the skeleton, if you like, that had been left behind from Lotus, there was an opportunity to build that team in a streamlined and a slick way. And they didn't do that. You know, he didn't do that. He chucked money into the wrong places. And Fred Vasseur over at Alpha, he just is what he is. He's just a journeyman F1 guy that's been there and done that. And, you know, it's not, you know, it's the dynamicism that they need to push forward. I just don't see at the moment in a number of the team bosses. And unfortunately, that's what sells. That's what sells the sport.
When you went for Gunter Steiner just then, I thought, oh no, the chat room is not gonna find that popular. But actually, people are agreeing with you, and people are saying that's the impression that they've gotten as well. And I think we've got kind of caught up with the Drive to Survive stuff because he's become a celebrity through his, like...
Because he swears a lot.
Yeah. And, like, he's personable. Well, like, you would want him to give your best man speech. Sorry, Trump is.
I don't know. You can compare pre-2017 and post-2017, but I just feel like if anyone has an impossible job, it's got to be him. Your team boss says, I want you to spend as little money as possible. Welcome to Formula One, where you win by spending the most money. That's not detracting from your opinion of him, but I think anyone in that position would be struggling at best. And it has come up in the chat room, like, what exactly was the specific reason that he was there?
I mean, with the greatest of respect, that's outside looking in. You have to remember that Gunter was the one that drove the deal. He drove the Haas deal.
Right.
You know, he was the one that decided that he wanted to do it. He was the one that got Gene Haas on board. He was the one that sold the dream to Gene Haas. Gunter Steiner has wanted to be in F1 or has been in and around F1 since he was a young man. And he really wanted to be a team principal. He wanted to push that. And he drove that narrative. So I don't feel sorry for him in the slightest. He made some decisions that weren't necessarily the best. And the killer decision is what they've got sitting in front of them now. Now, if you believe that Schumacher was pushed on them by Ferrari, the reason he was pushed on them was because they got a discount on their engines. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's a business decision. The Mazepin decision is a business decision because I'm sure his father is pumping cash into the team. So he's made those decisions and now he has to deal with them. And I don't know. I don't feel that he necessarily portrays himself in the best way.
Excellent. We are running short of time here, but the chat room is screaming at me to ask you one more thing. And then when you're finished with that, we'll get out of here, please.
No, just quickly before you ask me that, driver rivalries. Ooh, Julian and Roman was worse than Julian and Pasta. Than Roman and Pasta.
Why?
Roman hated Julian.
Really? But they both seemed so nice.
Because he was... So, again, we've discussed this before, I think, but Pasta had it written into his contract that I didn't sign his contract, but written into his contract that nobody could drive his car on a Friday. So if we had a test driver, then you couldn't drive his car on a Friday. I
Julian
did the deal with Charles
all.
Peak and then with Julian, where to me, it was a good source of revenue. I took cash from these young drivers and gave them a number of Friday afternoons, which to me was, you know, we weren't particularly fighting for anything, but we were fighting for survival. We were very much mid, you know, as long as we didn't come at the back end of the grid, then we were doing okay. So to me, it was a source of revenue, but I couldn't put either Charles or Julian into Pasta's car because his contract specifically said that I couldn't. So we had to give up Roman's car, and Roman believed that he was the better driver of the two. And he therefore believed that, you know, it was important to us as a team to get as much data on the Friday, which to a large extent, Roman was right, that we need to get a lot of data. And therefore putting a Charles Peak or a Julian Palmer in the car wasn't necessarily the best for the team. And I can't argue with that. But by the same token, I mean, Julian, if you ever get him on here or if you ever talk to him or if anyone ever sees him, he'll say that when he used to drive out of the garage on a Friday, Roman would be sitting on the pit wall next to me and Roman would stare daggers at him. And Julian was like, he was absolutely wetting himself for those first few laps because Roman was basically, you know, that's my baby, that's my car, you know, you be careful with it. I think I've said before, I was having dinner in, I think it was Bahrain. I don't know. Anyway, I was having dinner somewhere with Julian. So I'd just went down to the restaurant in the hotel and Julian was with me in the lift or whatever. And we went and we sat down and we ordered something to eat. And Roman came down with his trainer and he sat at a table across from us. And I sort of beckoned him over and he just shook his head. Mm. And I went over and spoke to him and said, what's up? And he said, I'm not going to come and sit over there with him. And then Julian went off to bed and then Roman came and sat at the table next to me. So there was, there was no love lost between them. And
so now I want to know if Roman Grosjean got on with any of his teammates.
Well, again, so in my time, I only ever saw him with Pasta and then Charles Peak and Julian as the reserve drivers. And he didn't get on with any of those three. You could say looking back at the history books, I don't think he got on particularly well with Magnussen.
I think him and Kimi got on okay, but that's just because Kimi was completely
passive.
He was just himself. He just didn't give a monkeys about anyone else or anything else. He didn't do any, you know, team related stuff. He never came to the simulator. Kimi was just Kimi.
Excellent. I've massively enjoyed that insight. And most of all, I enjoy the slight pauses where you go, nah, and you abort. I can hear a little message going like, abort, and then you duck out. But we always enjoy your insight. We don't have time for the questions that were pouring in. Everyone wants to know your opinion on the Ferrari team principle. But what I suggest is that I beg you to come and join us in the next few weeks once again. And not leave it so long. You've been a very busy man, but hopefully we can get you back on sooner rather than later.
Absolutely.
And we can follow you on social media, your brand new Twitter and TikTok accounts.
Nope.
So you're just going to have to wander around Canada until you find Mr. Carter. May I take this opportunity on the behalf of Mr. Apex Podcast to just thank you for your time and your insight.
No problem.
Thank you very much. I guess if you want to follow Matt, you can at MattPT55, I suppose.
I don't know why you do that, but yeah, you're welcome to.
But if you want like the details, we're getting pretty good at Mr. Apex Podcast at putting all the links in the show notes. So if you click the show notes in YouTube or on your podcast player and scroll down, you can follow all the panel. There'll be links to all the Twitter accounts and you can support us at patreon.com/Mr. Apex. It's a click of the button and that's the kind of thing that lets us sit here on a Tuesday and speak to wonderful people like Matthew Carter. And we've also lined up some fantastic things to provide for the Mr. Apex feed over the summer as well. We've got 6 shows in 3 races coming up. We've got Paul Ricard, a new show after that. Austria 1, a new show after that. We've got also Austria 2. Austria 2, the comeback. What's a good sequel name? Austria 2, this time it's personal. That's what it'll be. And then we've got a new show after that as well. So we are going to make this a festival of Formula 1 and podcasting. In that time period, just about every single member of the Mr. Apex crew will be making a panel appearance there. So please do join us. The next time will be Sunday, 8 o'clock UK time for our review of the French Grand Prix. Until then, work hard, be kind, and have fun. This was Mr. Apex Podcast. Matt, I don't know if you heard, but there was like a little weird. Did you press some kind of bumper or something, like, or like the wrong outro button? Then I think it was you. It could have been you.
Yes, I very clearly pressed the wrong outro button.
I can't believe it. Why would you
all the way over here across the pond?
Why would you do that, you idiot? Why? I can't believe. I'm so angry at you right now. I guess
I know. I'm Derek. On the left rear tire that will not come off. Was it the right front rounding off the nut?
It would show great maturity if I was to leave that mistake in and not edit it out. But however, I fear that won't be the case.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.